You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Sunday, December 7th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Tara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, Melbourne.
Yes, we are in Melbourne, Australia. This is our first time in Melbourne. We were our third time in Australia as the SGU. First time with Kara, though, right?
Yeah, first time together.
Yeah. So, of course, you know, we've been to Sydney twice, and now this is our first time in Melbourne. So, you know, we couldn't help compare the two cities, you know, and think about which one might be, better. I know there aren't any strong opinions about this in the audience. So we did, you know, we had some time to do some walking tours of the city.
Yeah, did a little analysis.
It's a beautiful city. The architecture is amazing.
Yeah, it is.
So definitely
striking.
Beautiful, beautiful architecture. This is just one of many pictures.
But Sydney has beautiful architecture.
They have the Opera House.
Yeah, my wife and I got engaged there, so, yeah.
So, you know, both beautiful cities.
Sure.
I don't know that you could call it that. You know, we did encounter some woo while we were here.
Not unusual in a large city. Not at all.
Any metropolitan area is
ubiquitous.
Yeah, you can't really knock it for that. So this one I had to unpack a little bit.
So my question is,
Jay, that's for you, by the way.
Why? Like, what's going on in this city that they need to tell people how to poop?
Just for reference, in the United States, we don't have to tell people how to use the toilet.
To be fair, in the United States, we're not near Southeast Asia.
Yeah,
right?
I understand.
We're countries where there are Eastern toilets.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's what we learned.
Yes.
Those instructions are in English, though, so there is that.
We had a competition, remember, a couple of nights ago at dinner. Everybody, go on your phone and pick the best picture from the past few days.
Yeah.
So this was the one Steve picked. We all passed it around, and Steve won.
Yeah.
My picture was better, but he still won anyway.
For the listeners at home, there's over the toilet in one of the restrooms, there's a picture that said it shows somebody squatting on top of the toilet with an X that says no.
With their feet on the
seat. Yeah, their feet on the seat, squatting on the seat. Yeah, and then somebody sitting on it, you know, properly saying, yes, this is the way you should poop.
So don't use a Western toilet like you would use an Eastern toilet,
right?
Basically.
Because Eastern toilets are basically holes in the ground that you squat over.
Yeah, and there's usually little spots for your feet.
Yeah, so they get confused when they come here.
You could fall off the toilet at that point.
Well, no, but remember,
it seems like
too,
a delicate procedure.
But also remember that culturally, you know, we grow up with our own norms. So to us, like, using an Eastern toilet is, like, weird and uncomfortable, and maybe we don't even think of it as clean. But to a lot of people that use Eastern toilets, they're like, you sit on a toilet seat?
I know.
That's disgusting.
It is disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
like,
how are you
going to... I'm going to put my feet up there. I'm not putting my butt on that.
That's disgusting.
Plus, when you squat, you get, like, a lot more separation.
The pressure.
Yeah.
Plus, where am I going to read the news?
I know. That would be
a good workout, Jay.
Yeah.
It's good for
my squats today.
It's good for the glutes.
If you think toilet talk is bad enough, wait till later.
Yeah.
I'll say no more.
All right. Bob. So, Bob, you have an fun anecdote. This actually one is from New Zealand. Talking about... we're adapting to the local accent. Yeah, we try our best. Sometimes, you know, I have to admit, there's been a couple of times over the last few days where somebody has walked up to me and said something to me, and I'm like, yeah, I have no idea what they're saying. And I do my best, but I don't necessarily catch every single word. But, Bob, tell us what happened to you when we were over the other in New Zealand.
Nothing, you know, it's nothing. Oh, that story. I was with Kara and Evan, and a gentleman walked up to me, great, nice guy. Hadn't met him before. He went over to Kara. Hi, Kara, how are you? Hi, Evan, how are you? Bob, how are you? I get that reaction a lot, you know. But he's like, Bob, I'm just like you. I like spice. And I'm like, yeah, I love hot food. I go to Thai food, I get it really, really hot. It's so good. He's like, no, not spice, spice. And I'm like, that's the same word you just said twice. And then he's like, no, outer spice. I'm like, oh. We're laughing our asses off.
So all of us. The whole trip, for no reason, one of us would just go, spice!
Ew, to spice.
But now when I say to myself, outer spice, it sounds right. It makes sense.
Okay. This picture, I have to orient you to the picture. There's a bird there, right? You see the head, the wings, it's kind of mounted. So we had a great, sort of back-of-the-scenes tour of the Melbourne Museum.
It's great.
I had his name in my head.
Rolf.
Rolf, thank you. Yeah. From Rolf, so thank you, Rolf, for that. So does everyone here know what kind of bird that is?
Dead.
Yes. It's a dead bird.
You stole my line.
It's a bird of prey.
See, I told you that
look
the picture
closely. Look closely.
Remember, I told you to do praying hands after you said that. All right, then they'll get it.
It's a bird of prey.
I am so disappointed in you, Steve.
Why?
Because I told him that this picture is complicated and that they won't be able to get what the joke is. This: the bird has a piece of plastic on its head to protect the feathers, right?
Jokes are amazing when you have to explain them.
But he already let it out of the cage. So I saw it and I said, that bird looks like a nun.
Right.
And I said, the bird's going, we must feed the children, And then Steve goes, no, that's a bird of prey.
Yeah, actually, it was Ian who said bird of prey.
Or Ian did.
Ian.
Oh. Blame Ian. Sure, Steve.
I told you.
All right. They don't always work. All right.
You got to take a risk.
No one's walking out.
While we're thanking people, we also had a great dinner at a local Italian restaurant, right, Jane?
Yeah, so Les has been a listener, I think, for a number of years, and he has heard me on the show talk about meatballs and everything. And they have a restaurant called Al Antico. He emailed us about 3 or 4 months ago, and he said, hey, come to the restaurant. So we're in a mad fever. We're trying to plan the trip and everything. And then we all decided collectively, yeah, let's go to that restaurant. So we did it. We went on Wednesday night, and it was family style. We had an amazing time. And the most important thing is the meatballs are excellent.
Everything
this is legit Italian food.
It was great.
And his wife does all the cooking. Everything is handmade. Nothing is store-bought. So I'm recommending you go because it's good food, not because of Les and his adorable family. But the food is amazing.
But also that too.
Yeah, but the family was amazing. They also gave me a cookbook that shows you how to make homemade olives.
Mm-hmm. How you make olives?
Olives? No, you have to grow the olives. Yeah. Right? Prepare olives.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I guess maybe you could 3D print them or something. Then you're making. All right.
All right. I'll stop. Time to make the olives.
So this is also at the museum. That is a piece
of what?
Of Mars. That is a piece
that was
of
cool.
Mars.
Whoa.
You
that
might
was cool.
be asking yourself, how do we know that's a piece of Mars? We've never brought anything back from Mars.
Steve, now isn't it true that for that rock to get to Earth, it had to travel through outer space?
Yes. That's true.
Should have seen that coming.
Did we already thank Rolf Schmidt?
Yeah,
we did.
Where the hell have you been?
Sure. Did we say his last name?
No, we didn't.
No, we didn't. Karen's like, don't forget the restaurant we went to.
I want to make sure that Rolf Schmidt
gets a shout out.
And what
about Amanda?
It was super. We're not there yet. We're still talking about the museum.
Okay, so we'll get there.
Yeah.
So it was an asteroid, obviously, a meteorite. So there's a meteorite. So we collect the meteorite. How do we know that meteorite came from Mars? Meaning that some point in the past, something struck Mars, threw up debris, some of that escaped orbit, meandered around the solar system, and then one of those pieces landed on Earth and then was collected by somebody, and boom, there you go.
And plus, if you look closely, it says made in Mars.
On Mars. So I asked Rolf that question. It wasn't Rolf. It was the other guy who was a meteorite guy.
He said,
like, there's a certain feature that you know it's from the inner solar system. So right away, you know it's either from Mercury, Mars, or Venus, right away. Mm-hmm. And then, so as opposed to all the other asteroids. Very few asteroids escape from Venus because of the atmosphere. So I think very few will get chucked out into space or spice. And then it's pretty easy to tell the difference between Mercury and Mars, apparently.
Yeah, but that's not the hard part.
Yeah.
The hard part is, how the hell did somebody find the rock and decide to, hey, out of all the other rocks, this is the one I'm going to examine?
So, yeah, one way is, like, if you're in Antarctica and there's rocks on top of the snow, that's a meteorite.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's one way.
Same in the
desert.
Or in the desert. There's a rock on top of the sand in the desert, that's a meteorite.
All right, that makes it easy.
Otherwise, you have to know what they look like. And he showed us, like, they're pitted and they also, if they came through the atmosphere, they'll have a crust on the outside. It kind of looks a little shiny.
And some of them are actually magnetic, so a lot of people go around with
that. Jay, you and I would look right past it.
Oh,
experts would be like,
we all probably
have. The right part of
the cool thing that he let us do is he let us smell
Ooh.
Remember, cool. It was a chondrite.
Yeah.
So he passed it around, yep. And it looked like a brown charred piece of rock. And he said, "Smell this. What does it smell like?" And not kidding, I said it smells like space because I figured, you know, it had to come from outer space. But it did smell like charcoal, right? It had like a coal kind of smell to it. Yeah. And then he told us that this is like how many billions of years old.
4.6 billion year old.
Just kicking around in the solar system.
Still emanating, what, the amino acids that were present at the time.
Breaking down organic molecules, right. And we could smell those byproducts of that.
So, getting back to our Sydney versus Melbourne thing, because we're not done with that. I have to say it was kind of a toss-up between Sydney and Melbourne. What do you guys think?
Yeah,
really? Like, a toss-up?
I mean, they're two cities that are extraordinarily different from each other. They have a totally different feel.
Yeah.
They both had good food. I think, you know, Melbourne had better food.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
But while we were walking around Melbourne, we did see one thing that I think did tip it a little bit.
Yes.
And that was, yeah. I mean, of course. Any city with a life-size TIE fighter... Yeah. I think gets the edge.
So Steve saw it first, and this is all I heard from Steve. Steve's talking, because we're always talking. He's like, blah, 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 blah. Holy shit! So we immediately were like, what?
So it was either a bird or a TIE fighter, and it happened to be a TIE fighter.
Well, it literally was right in front of us for like minutes, and none of us saw it, because we were on the side.
Really.
We were on the side. It was
completely occluded.
It wasn't. But so you could only see like the profile of the wing from the outside, but then that shape just clicked in my brain.
We ran up like school children.
See, extra points.
Images in their minds of us walking like where we are here and not noticing.
We were coming from the side.
Okay.
All right, whoever raises their hand with the correct answer first, what does the word TIE in TIE Fighter mean? Right there.
That guy.
Twin ion engine.
Yeah, there yes.
You want Very a pen. Come see me for a pen. Excellent job.
All right. Bob's going to start us off with a Your Numbers Up.
So, yes, this is Your Numbers Up. It's my exciting new segment that I started this year. You may remember previous installments where I talked about Graham's number and 666, some of my favorite numbers. Another top five number is Hubble's constant. That's a pretty common number that people have heard of. It's named after, as you may have guessed, Edwin Hubble.
Humble.
But he was very humble. I hear he was very humble. He was an American astronomer, and he was not the first scientist to discover that that galaxies are expanding, everything is expanding away. He was the one who discovered that they're expanding faster and faster the farther out you get. So that was pretty huge. And he was also the first one who attempted to calculate exactly what Hubble's constant was. I don't think they called it Hubble's constant way back then.
Before he discovered before it, probably not.
But his number, and this is way back in 1929, so obviously he wasn't very accurate. So we've been getting increasingly accurate. So what is it? What is Hubble's constant? It's a relation between for example, a galaxy's distance to its velocity. So I want to plot. I'm going to do a little human plot. Jay, what did you want this to be, like an interpretive dance? Type of thing.
Yeah, well, Bob wanted us. He's like, "Can you lift your arm?" I'm like, "Wait, so you want us to get up and dance? Like, what's happening here?"
Well, Steve, give me an X Y axis.
So if this is distance
and velocity, Jay, give me a straight line in the middle.
But wait, we should do it for the audience. It's the other way for the audience.
But I need Jay.
Okay. All right.
So this is the safety dance.
things in reverse. So this would be the relation. So there's a direct relation between the velocity and the distance, and so it's a straight line. So the slope of Jay's arm, that's Hubble's constant.
That's better. Yeah.
That slope is Hubble's constant.
It's on the screen.
All right, so we're good with that. So Hubble's constant is denoted by the letter H sub zero. That subscript means at present time, and the units are fascinating. If you give a number, say Hubble's constant is 50, that means 50 kilometers per second. Per megaparsec. So a parsec, should we even get into that parallax?
No.
It means a parsec is 3.26 light years. Look it up. Fascinating.
Millennium Falcon. Parsec.
Portmanteau or portmanteau?
Portmanteau.
So that's hundreds of millions of light years. So for every million parsecs, if the number is 50 kilometers, every megaparsec, it's going 50 kilometers per second faster. So the more you go out, it increases by those increments. So that's what the units mean. And let's see, and there's a huge controversy over Hubble's constant, because there's two ways to measure it. You could look at the nearby universe, and you could look at things like standard candles, like supernova 1As. You could look at Cepheid variables, and you could determine, all right, Hubble's constant is, they come up with 74 kilometers per second per megaparsec. But if you look at the early universe and you figure it out, then it's 67 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Those two numbers are wild, you know, there's a huge disparity between the two. That's a problem, because no matter how you calculate each of these numbers, they always come out to be right around there. So they can't figure out what's going on. So it's a real controversy. If they ever solve it, it'll be really big. Let's see, the final thing about Hubble's constant, that it's not a constant. It's really not even a constant. It's a parameter, Hubble's parameter. And that's because Hubble's constant is a constant in space, but not in time. So far in the future or far in the past, Hubble's constant would be different. So if you want
to call it Hubble's variable.
That's not how it works, Steve. So if you want to be a pedant and somebody talks about Hubble's constant, say, did you know it really is Hubble's parameter?
Hubble's parameter.
Yes.
Okay.
I'll accept that.
Yes.
So, okay, that's it. This was your numbers up. Perhaps one day you'll think of me fondly when your number is up.
This is another picture I took here in Melbourne. And when I saw this person walking by, I immediately thought of two things. They're not the same two things that Jade thought of. Why is this person wearing a mask, right? And does it work? Yeah. Does it actually help? Now, it's also, we have this in the United States as well, but it's not as prevalent. There was a lot of people walking around Melbourne wearing face masks, all Asian, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely a cultural thing going on. Definitely, same thing in the U.S. The only people I see doing this in the U.S. are Asians. And I didn't know why that was. Turns out in 2003, China was having an outbreak of SARS, a respiratory virus, and the government recommended that the citizens wear face masks. And that basically kicked off this cultural thing of wearing face masks in order to reduce the risk of both acquiring and spreading respiratory infections. So, okay, so that answered that question. Then the second question is, does it actually work? What do you guys think?
It doesn't work.
It depends what you mean by work.
Depends. No,
it doesn't work.
Yeah. What does the audience think? Yes?
Doesn't work at all.
Yeah, about the same.
You're just a bunch of skeptics.
Doesn't work at all.
It works. It works. It definitely works. But it depends. Evan's a closer. Bob said, Bob is right. It depends. So it does block large particles, right? So if you cough or sneeze, it will definitely prevent the large particles from spraying out, you know, into the environment. So in terms of giving illness to other people, it's partially effective. It's, you know, definitely significantly reduces the risk, but not by 100%, right? So it doesn't block viral particles. They're too small, but it does block droplets and larger particles. What about if you're does it protect the person wearing the mask?
No.
It does. But again, it depends. So, because you also breathe in droplets and people can sneeze in your general direction. Sneezes can go like 30 feet. I mean, they can go wide. But basically, if you have the flu, let's say, you're surrounded by about a 10-foot cloud of viruses and droplets and disease, right? So the recommendation is, you guys have a CDC too. We have a CDC and you have a CDC, although they call it something slightly different, but the same initials.
Really?
Both CDCs recommend that if you want to not catch the flu, stay 10 feet away from people with the flu. That's the best way to do it. Wash your hands. Mm-hmm. Don't touch your eyes and your mouth with your hands if you haven't washed them. But wearing a face mask, if you wear it properly, and consistently,
like sealed.
Yeah, it's got to seal along the nose, and it's got to go under your chin, and you know, it has to be closed on the outside. Then it does actually reduce your risk of getting the illness. Of getting it, not just giving it. If you're using it properly and consistently, and you're around sick people.
Yeah. So, like, if you are flying during flu season, and you should get vaccinated. Yeah. But if you can't get the flu vaccine for
or
some
even if
reason.
You can, they also both say, but get vaccinated. Right, the most effective way is to get vaccinated, but even still, you get some extra protection.
So you're saying wear the mask.
In places like with high population density where there's a real risk.
Like a city.
So the question is, here's where the controversy is. Out in the public, when you're not sick and you're not around people who are known to be sick, so in the general community setting, There's no real evidence that it's effective. And the CDC, the Australian CDC, does not recommend. They say there's insufficient evidence to recommend wearing a face mask out in the public.
Just like prophylactically.
Just prophylactically, yeah. So if you're sick, yes. If you're around sick people, like in close proximity to sick people, yes. But not instead of other things because it's not that effective, but it is effective. So it's, of course, like one of those complicated answers. It depends.
But during like some sort of epidemic or
if there's an epidemic, it's certainly something you could do, and that's when it was first recommended. But now just people are doing it just to like everyday sort of thing, like almost as a fashion statement. And there's not really any evidence, and it's not recommended.
But if you're walking around the city of Beijing, for example, which is a pretty dirty city, I've never been. Has anyone? I imagine some people here have been. You know, you may just want to not have those particles.
Well, but I think there's a difference between wearing it for disease prevention and wearing it because the pollution is so bad.
So that's correct, and that's a separate thing that's been researched. So does it help against pollution? The answer is pretty clearly no.
But I was right.
It may block out.
It may block out
some of the larger particles, but the small ones that get down into your lungs, no. Yeah. In fact, there was a paper published in Nature recently this year where they said, you know what? If the face masks may actually worsen exposure to pollution because people get a false sense of security.
No. Okay.
Oh. Because people think, oh, I could be out in the pollution longer because I'm wearing a face mask, and they really can't. And so it's one of those things like, you know, you get a false sense of security, so you might get overexposed and have more risk.
Well, so what about, I mean, and I don't know if you studied this explicitly, but kind of respirators for individuals like, you know, many people are dealing with this right now living in Sydney. And we saw a really, really brutal wildfire season in Southern California. And there were kind of like higher particulate matter, not lawnmower masks like medical face masks, surgical but masks specifically for...
There's a respirator, so I did look into that.
Yeah, okay.
So for disease transmission, there was like the famous nurses study that would show no difference. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it doesn't seem to matter what kind of mask you use, so which means it's not like you need some high-tech surgical mask, whatever. It's just physically blocking the large particles. For pollution, I didn't really get deep into the weeds on pollution, but I would think that, if you had anything that's actually filtering out the finer particles would be beneficial.
Especially for someplace where there's literally, like, ash falling down.
All right, so now I'm completely do I wear a mask or not?
No. It depends.
It depends. All right, Evan.
This is what I was talking about.
This is a perfectly normal activity. Don't be judgmental. So why are these people lying naked with their legs akimbo?
Hey, I gotta put on my glasses for this. I'm taking my glasses off. why the heck? What is going on here? Some people may be familiar with this particular image and other images like it on the internet. This is called perineum sunning.
Perineum
sunning is what it's called.
Perineum.
Yes, that's right. So,
because that's the perineum is where the sun don't shine. Normally,
yeah, it's between your hoo ha and your right.
Don't get technical. How do you spell that?
Between your junk and your trunk.
Okay.
The skin that lies.
Proceed.
Yes.
Okay. We talked about this at breakfast for about an hour.
So, I wasn't eating at the time, I assure you. So just in October, this apparently became a popular thing, a meme, if you want to call it that. Some guru online posted a picture of this and then herself doing it because, well, there are a lot of claims saying that this is actually good for you. Let me give you the quick list here of the benefits of sunning this area of your body.
They call it ass bathing, by the way.
They call it ass something, that's for sure. Okay, so it will bring in prana, or solar energy from the sun, into the organs with the body, which strengthens the organs.
Yeah,
organ
sure.
strengthening.
Yep. Sounds good.
Also, it will prevent against the leakage of chi, or life force energy, flowing from the body.
Wait, Evan.
Jay?
So chi leaks out our buttholes?
You would think people would like capture it and resell it, you know? Because that'd be valuable. Like liquid chi would be.
You could just plug it up, right? Then.
No.
Prevent anal chi leakage.
It also promotes longevity of the physical body. Mm-hmm. What other body?
As opposed to
the incorporeal body. increases creativity. Now yeah. maybe that I'll give you. that is creative. Matt, that might be. Aids in a healthy libido and balanced sexual energy. That's one, right, Bob? That's one of the energy forces of the universe.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to think of what unbalanced sexual energy means. Oh, I think I have a few ideas.
I'm sure there are graphics for that as well. 30 seconds of doing this is apparently the equivalent of being in the sun all day long with clothes on. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just do this for 30 seconds is what
they're
saying.
I'd like to see that study.
Now, this will also ground and connect you to the earth.
Oh,
that is
good.
A benefit.
That's great.
Grounding you to the earth in case lightning strikes. What? I mean,
as opposed to earthing you to the ground, which is a totally
that is thing. Entirely different. A different subject. It will increase your personal magnetism and amplify your auric field.
Like actual magnetism?
No, animal magnetism.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, for the mesmer fans out there. You will attain better focus and mental stimulation. And finally, it will regulate hormone function in the sex organs. These are the list of supposed benefits that the gurus and the people who are trying to tell you to do this for your health. So instead of that, I actually went and looked up what doctors were saying about this. Real doctors, such as dermatologists, oncologists, and others. Okay, so what they're saying is it will do none of those, obviously, but it will increase your risk of skin cancer.
Which is actually ass cancer.
And there is such
right?
a thing.
As there is ass cancer, but this is specific. No, that is a thing. I mean, they don't call it ass cancer. But
so
if Jay was a doctor, cancer. That's what he would call it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, we're all familiar with Gwyneth Paltrow, right?
Yes.
Famous actress, and she has all sorts of interesting ideas on health and wellness and these sorts of things. She promotes a whole litany of products and ideas about well-being, and they're all crap. Now, unfortunately, this has gotten into the minds of some other celebrities. You ever heard of a person named David Asprey? He's a lifestyle guru, and he's been trying this out and, I guess, promoting it. There's a famous DJ named Diplo, D-I-P-L-O?
Diplo.
Diplo. From increases creativity and creative output. So he also has gone ahead and tried it. And, of course, perhaps the most famous of them, the actor Josh Brolin. You may have seen Josh Brolin in many different movies. He was Thanos, right? Yeah, Avengers, yeah. We all know that. So, so Josh did this, and he had a little problem. he kind of got sunburned because he was out there maybe more than 30 seconds doing it and had some pretty serious burns, and he spent several days recovering from these burns. And I'll read you the quote in which he kind of sums it up. I don't know who the F thought of this stupid S, but F you nonetheless.
Seriously.
Josh Brolin.
That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah. How right. do you add to that? I don't even know.
All right. See, cutting edge science on the Skeptics Guide.
Yeah.
All right, Jay, tell us about these penguins.
It turns out that penguins do some funky ass stuff that most people didn't know about. So in March of... let me give you a little history lesson here. This is kind of... This is interesting. So in March of 1912, a naval surgeon and zoologist named George Murray Levick was part of an expedition to the South Pole. Five of his fellow explorers went to actually go to where they thought the real South Pole was, and he stayed back, and he was, you know, hidden in a snow mound, and he was observing the Adélie penguins and taking notes. So all five of his companions died that exact day. But he survived because they froze to death trying to get back from wherever they thought the South Pole was. So in 1914, he published a book about the observations that he had about the penguins. The interesting thing is he left some information out, some very specific information out of his notes. This is the story of what he left out and why. Now keep in mind, he observed the penguins for a month and he got to see the penguins during the breeding season. And he saw them having sex, mating rituals, and basically hooking up with other penguins, cheating on their partners, and there was also penguin rape and penguin prostitution, which, you're not laughing, there's something humorous about this to me. The question that comes to mind is, what is penguin currency? Because you can't have prostitution
fish,
without currency, right?
Stones?
I don't know. It's a question that needs to be answered. So
So Levick wrote a manuscript that gave a sanitized version of what he observed. And he had this secret second manual, the second manuscript he wrote, and it contained all the other information with all the sensual details about what he saw. So he called this second manuscript The Sexual Habits of the Adelie Penguin. And this was in 1915. But the manuscript was literally stamped, not for publication, and it remained unpublished for almost 100 years.
Not suitable for work, right? NSFW, yeah. Is that? Yeah.
So now let's jump to 2012. So Levick, who was the guy I just told you about, his second manuscript resurfaces, and it got published in a scientific journal. So there was a penguin biologist named Lloyd Spencer Davis. So Mr. Davis thought that he was the first person to record this same-sex sexual behavior that the Antarctic penguins had, and this happened in 96. So he reads this article, and then he immediately is like, he doesn't understand why Levick's second manuscript was hidden from the scientific community. So what did he do? He went on a personal mission to find out the answer to that question. And this is the part that will semi-blow your mind. So Davis ended up writing a book called Polar Affair that goes into all the details of what he found. And during the Victorian era or modern day, scientists are tempted to view penguin sexuality with an anthropomorphic point of view. Mm-hmm. And it's not just penguins. It's lots of
literally every animal ever observed.
So Davis wanted to understand, and this is his words, why Murray Levick would discover the dirty side of penguins and then try to cover it up.
Why would he call that dirty?
That's what he said. Yeah, I don't know.
That's the point, right. Is that the assumption that it's somehow dirty.
Deviant.
Yeah. So that's the filter through which they're seeing.
Yeah, it's like there's just overt homophobia within the scientific community going back, you know, centuries. And so, of course, as we see, like, sexism and racism, like, kind of colonial issues, like, moving through the sciences, because the sciences are done by through a certain lens, you're also seeing that a lot of literature on same-sex behavior within animals has been literally just redacted.
Yeah.
Because they thought, oh, that's not polite.
People don't want to know about that. Right?
Or that it's not natural.
Right? And what that actually does, instead of normalizing normal, typical, natural behavior, it actually makes it appear to be more aberrant, and it continues this kind of repressive view.
And so it's self-fulfilling.
It's horrible. It's like the literature on same-sex behavior in animals, I think, probably has had a very negative result,
a negative feedback
toward human society.
Yeah.
I
mean, yeah. I mean, if you think about the way that our culture works, we get conditioned, for better or for worse, to understand things and to become familiar with things. You know, you look at this and you're like, wow, so this one scientist, I mean, penguins, these are penguins. You know, we're not even talking about things that even look like humans, like, you know, apes or chimpanzees. We're talking about animals that look very different than human beings. And they had this behavior that this scientist, I guess, he thought that, hey, this is not cool. I don't want to tell the world about this. And I find that to be so weird.
Probably like, thought maybe perhaps his career could be in jeopardy if he were to actually go ahead and publish these things.
It might not even be that. I mean, I think it's part of a broader thing where you look at some data, you look at as the exception, right? Mm-hmm. So there's the real data, and then those are exceptions. But that's a way of biasing your sample, right? Because it's like, no, that's not an exception. That's data. That's just more data. And you have to look at all of it. So if you go into this observation with the predetermined assumption that, you know, opposite sex interactions are normal, natural behavior, anything else is therefore unnatural, deviant, exceptions. We don't have to worry about that. It's not part of what penguins really do. It's just this weird, you know, exception.
And unfortunately, that kind of cognitive bias underlies a lot of tribalism within human society.
Yeah. So, you know, it's confirmation bias.
Yeah, we have ethnocentric monoculturalism in almost every nation, right? Mm-hmm. This idea that there is the majority culture and everything else is the other.
Yeah.
And there's a homogenization of the other. And there's also, to maintain these tribalistic views, you'll see people with like deep kind of racial, like deep racism. They might have a friend who is black or a friend who is gay. And it's like, oh, but they're the exception.
They're the exception.
Right? They're like the cool one.
Saying the exception is a way of dismissing
data.
It's
really horrible, horrible. And the fact that actual scientists, you know, have been doing this throughout human history, I think in many ways because society has promoted it. And like you said, maybe it's this guy. But he was living in a culture where probably if he had come back with that data, people might not have wanted to hear it.
Yeah. Right.
And they might have questioned him or put
terrible. It's just terrible.
Ostracized, sure.
I'm bummed out now.
All right, well,
Except,
Kara.
Like, yay for gay animal sex. And that's the thing too. There's so many great books written about this because it's been observed in like every species. Yeah.
But I'm not okay with rape. I don't care if it's dolphins or penguins. Like, that's not cool.
Coercion?
And we should go up and tell those goddamn penguins to cut the shit.
Coercion is very common in the animal kingdom, unfortunately.
Ducks, right? Ducks are assholes.
And like a lot of animals are a bit rapey.
But again, we can't really impose our human morality onto animals.
Just read about bonobos sometime. It's really fun.
Bonobos.
A lot of cool
stuff.
All right,
so Kara.
Yeah.
This looks like a very sophisticated analysis that I'm looking at here.
Of
these paragraphs. So tell me about the really hard science behind what's happening here.
Okay, so have you guys heard of something called SCAN? It's short for Scientific Content Analysis. Most people haven't. This is something that is sold by a company called the Laboratory for Scientific Interrogation. And according to one of very few studies that have ever been published about it, it has, quote, no empirical support. Unfortunately, it is used by law enforcement agencies in 49 of the 50 states in the U.S., the CIA, the FBI, and across several nations, including Australia.
Sounds like polygraphs.
So what is it, though? What are they actually doing?
So interesting that you mentioned polygraphs, because the guy who actually invented this platform, he's an Israeli ex-polygraph analyst.
Hey, there you go.
And he has used this to analyze passages from Genesis, and he has also used this as he wrote his master's thesis on interrogation in Jewish law. And this is actually a tool that professionals will use to take statements of either witnesses or actual suspects in crimes. And it's basically handwriting analysis. I mean, it's a bunch of different debunk techniques all mixed together. So there's a color coding system that you can kind of see up there where, you know, blue stands for specific pronouns and green and purple have different uses within it. And there are all these kind of very subjective, interpretive ways that police and other intelligence community officials will analyze the testimony of individuals. And this has not just sent people to prison countless times, but it's sentenced people to life imprisonment. It's sentenced people to death. The reason you've not heard of it is because there is a standard, at least within in American courtrooms. You can't bring polygraph evidence into the courtroom, right? You can't apparently bring SCAN evidence into a courtroom, but it doesn't matter because this is the first line for police who will often say, I think this is my suspect. Now I'm confirmed that this is my suspect. Right. Now I'm going to stop looking at other suspects and collect all of the confirming evidence that I can find. And this was a big expose by ProPublica, which is an investigative reporting group, a nonprofit investigative newsroom in the U.S. They do some really, really incredible investigative work. And it's a long article. I highly recommend you look it up online because there's a lot of stuff I can't even share with you. But for example, you guys know about Comey, right? I don't know if you guys have gotten that deep into American politics, but he recently wrote a memoir. And the guy who runs the SCAN program actually went through and used SCAN on his memoir. And it's kind of amazing because he said, based on the fact that Comey talked about opening and closing a door 14 times within the first few chapters, he is apparently was a victim of childhood sexual abuse. This is his interpretation. And Comey had an amazing response. He emailed back to ProPublica when they asked him for a comment. No comment, never heard of the alleged tool. And by using the word never in conjunction with the word heard, I mean only never heard and not to suggest childhood trauma. Oh, I'm sorry about your $5, because it cost $5 for ProPublica to be able to read the report as well. And this is, this is kind of an extreme and funny example of something that happened when they publicly were able to bring this into the light. But the scary thing is that this is used in interrogation as an interrogation tool the world over and is actually putting people to death. And I think this is one in a long line of really great investigations that ProPublica is doing on bad forensics. Mm-hmm. So bloodstain analysis, photograph analysis, and things of that, even fingerprint analysis. I highly, highly recommend, as skeptics, that if you haven't started reading up on some of the bad forensics and the kind of misappropriation of legitimate science and utilization of just outright junk, you know, rank pseudoscience within the judicial system across the globe. It's fascinating, mm-hmm. and it's important, and I think it could be a really important area of advocacy for skeptics.
Totally. I think this is an area where we really need to start upping our game. This is classic pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. This is like so many features of it. And what we can see in here, so there's a lot of use of metaphor,
you know,
which is a very common thing in pseudosciences. You know, like,
it's all interpretation.
Yeah, it's all
super subjective.
It's very subjective interpretation. But again, that metaphor, like, you know, we talked about opening and closing a door, therefore that's sexual abuse.
But where did, you know, the question is, and it seems so obvious, I guess, to people like us, but like, based on what study are you, did the door
come
up?
You know? That's right. There's nothing. It's like the handwriting analysis. Like, oh, you have a swoop to your A or something. That swoop signifies a soaring person. No, it signifies that's how I write my A.
Yeah, they make these real distinctions in this. So basically, there's three steps to scan.
Yeah.
Give the subject a pen and paper. Ask the subject to write down his or her version of what happened.
And make up everything from there.
Analyze the statement and solve the case.
Solve the case.
it's like, and then a miracle happens. And the interesting thing is they have all of these different lists of this denotes lying, this denotes deception, and this denotes truth telling. And it's so arbitrary. It's like if they say, what did you do yesterday? And you say, went to the store, you're probably lying. But if you say, I went to the store, you're emphatically telling the truth.
So, Kara, have they ever given this to multiple people who claim to have this skill to be able to interpret this and see if they came up with different analysis depending on the person who
there is one scientific study that was done on this, and it came back that there's no empirical support for it whatsoever. But this is a black box in many ways. You know, this is a for-profit tool, and there are agencies around the world spending tens, sometimes even hundreds of thousands of dollars to train on this tool across their agency. It's not just pseudoscience. I mean, this is charlatanism. Yeah. This is a scam. Yeah. Well, it should be called scam. Terrible. Yeah. So, yeah. I highly recommend you guys read about this. Scientific content analysis. Right? Rule number one out of the pseudoscientist playbook, make it sound like science.
Scientific content analysis.
Science.
Yeah. No, it's terrible. It's all confirmation bias. Again, so it, like I was talking about before, people want the simple way to hack the system.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't have to do like a careful investigation and all that, you know, hard work. You can do this sort of shortcut magical analysis that will give you the answer. You could know if they're telling the truth or not. The number of assumptions that are going on here are countless. You can't even imagine.
Well, but it gives whoever this magical person is sitting there doing the analysis, it gives them like this deific control over.
Here is a person who's actually believes in scan. He's performed several dozens of scan analyses in different cases. He was one of few people that was willing to speak to ProPublica about utilizing it. He said, more often than not, scan pointed him in the right direction. He was able to solve the case. Quote, you ask me how does scan work? I can't tell you that. It really is, for lack of a better term, a faith-based system because you can't see behind the curtain.
It's like dowsing. I mean,
I also assume, you know, that, like, so you, like, if you're reading the statement of a witness, there's a lot of actual information in there as well,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So they're probably just getting an impression based upon non-scan analysis, just an ordinary analysis.
A hunch.
And then everything else is just confirmation bias.
But then they're drawing amazing inferences, like when they were looking at the Mueller report, because they also scanned that. They showed that because something was sometimes referred to as a computer and sometimes referred to as a laptop, that was evidence of deception. Mm-hmm. But if they had called it a computer consistently throughout, then you're telling the truth.
Clearly, because you would never otherwise.
No, you would never use a synonym.
Yeah.
That apparently, it's horrible.
It makes me so pissed off.
Like, me too. I'm like mad.
Like, I just want the
I'm
whole
really
thing
mad.
To go away.
Yeah, I know. We got to do something about this, guys. Who's with me?
Let's have dinner first, and then we'll do something about it.
Plan it over dinner. Yeah.
I honestly, though, would like to ask our contacts at the CIA about this, if they're using it.
Yeah, there's only been one record, but it's such a black box, too. Like, will they tell us? Well, I can neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah, probably, but at least they'll know that, you know, you guys should look into this. This is rank pseudoscience. Yeah. If this is going on at the CIA, please look into it.
$132,500 purchase for scan in 2014 by the U.S. State Department.
Yeah, the State Department. It's terrible. Mm. So, Bob, I'm looking at a mossy rock, but that represents the plants going from the ocean to the land. That was not an easy thing to do, but tell us about that.
Yeah, this was fascinating. I usually cover things like physics and astronomy, usually not something biological or evolutionary-based, but this one really was interesting.
Unless it's bacteria.
Unless, of course, bacteria or archaea. So a new study elucidates more than ever before that event, that milestone in history when plants started taking over, I mean, actually inhabiting land where there was nothing. I mean, there's literally nothing there before that event. So, I mean, talk about a milestone. It's called terrestrialization. And it's one. There's a handful of events in evolutionary history that were pretty crucial and interesting and would have changed the entire face of the Earth if it didn't happen. And this is one of them. So it started with it's an international project. Lots of international companies working together. They sequenced the genomes of 10,000 different plant species. Got a quote from Shilang Chegg, who was the first author. They said, let's see, the approach that we used, phylogenomics, which have you ever heard of that? I've never heard about that.
Yeah.
Phylogenomics is a powerful method to pinpoint the underlying molecular mechanism of evolutionary novelty. That's something pretty critical to find out. When I looked up phylogenomics, that really didn't come up. It was more phylogenetics, so I think it's kind of a...
Phylogenomics is basically like a whole field, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess there are tools within it.
Well, now that we can sequence the genomes of entire species, and we could do... Like, remember when it took 20 years to do one? Now we could do... Here's 10,000 of them. You could crunch those numbers, like really look for the evolutionary relationships and at the genetic level, you know, like say... Because genes have an evolutionary history as well, a branching history of descent, just like individual organisms do.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's what they're tracing.
No, I did not know that plants originated in the sea.
Of course. Everything did.
Yeah.
Of course.
Who
of
here
course.
Knew that?
Primordial soup.
Yeah. So about half of us
didn't
know.
Didn't. Okay.
So don't be disrespectful like that. But then I was thinking...
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, when you think of dirt, you go in your backyard, you know, and you got it, and there's brown dirt in there. That has biomatter in it.
So, yeah.
So before plants moved out of the sea, the dirt, it was just probably sandy and, you know, rocky. It wasn't like...
Well, did bacteria beat plants to the land? That's a quick question.
Yes.
So in a foot race, bacteria beats plants.
Bacteria are everywhere. Just make that assumption and you're
okay,
good.
So then dirt could have started to happen before plants came to the...
Care, you have something?
Oh, just according to the internet, phylogenetics versus phylogenomics.
Yes.
So phylo is referring to our understanding of evolution based on these things. Genetics specifically refers to looking at individual genes or clusters of genes. And genomics is the whole genome of the organism.
Gotcha, makes sense.
Yeah, that's
much
the
broader. Okay,
them.
So what they did was that two particular algae really caught their attention. One they had discovered before, it was known. The other one was brand new. No one had ever seen it before. But one thing that they did know about both of them was they were close relatives to plants, so that was important. So if you look at algae's history, it's interesting. For hundreds of millions of years, algae existed in fresh water around the Earth, kind of like between, you know, at the edges of where the fresh water meets the land. And occasionally that algae, it would get dried up. I mean, this is a wet area, but if you're in like a puddle or a riverbed, it's going to dry up. You're going to have extremes of weather where things just don't stay consistent. So that's a problem. If it dries up and you're not used to the air and the land, you're going to have a problem. So Michael Melkonian, that's University of Duisburg, Essen in Germany, his name just struck me. Melkonian. Does that sound like a Star Trek alien?
Yeah.
Like, Captain, the Melkonians are attacking.
Actually, the first thing I thought it was meconium, which is...
Yeah, that's gross.
Fetal poop, if you don't know what that is.
So Mr. Melkonian said these algae mingled with and received key genes from soil bacteria that helped them and their descendants to cope with the harsh terrestrial environment and eventually evolve into the land plant flora that we see today. So mingling, what does mingling mean? In this context, It's fascinating. Jay, yeah. I'll ask you a question. So if I reference like the mingling of Neanderthals and Homo erectus, you'd probably have a good idea what I mean if they mingled genetically, right? You'd have an image in your mind.
Dance
of what's
parties.
Yeah, they're dance mingling. Parties. Exactly what I was
to,
going
to
for.
To rock and roll.
Yep. So gene transfer, there's a couple different ways for a gene transfer, more than a couple, but there's two big categories. You have vertical transfer, parent to a child. That's the main way that everyone thinks of. But any other type of gene transfer besides that is called vertical or horizontal gene transfer. And that can happen in a lot of different ways, and this is what happened. Bacteria are kings and queens of horizontal gene transfer. Some of them can create a plasmid and exchange genetic material. It's a fascinating process, and that's how bacteria become so immune to all of our drugs, because different species of bacteria can exchange genes that way. So, and it even happens to humans. That can actually happen to humans in some very rare cases, not necessarily, you know, a plasmid like bacteria, but people can exchange genes with environmental DNA that just happens to be around, whether it's plants or insects.
A lot of it is viruses, you know. So retroviruses absolutely. Insert their DNA into the human genome. Occasionally, that finds its way into the other one, the germline. And then it can get passed down.
Yeah, and generally, it's not that big of a deal.
No, especially our genomes loaded with viral inclusions.
Right.
They actually become good markers of evolution, because inserted, then everything that descends after that point will have that same inclusion. Rarely that DNA could get incorporated into an active gene.
Right. Yeah, there's so much junk DNA. But I mean, you could have absorbed some genes today from something unrelated. But when it gets to the germline, that's when you actually affect the evolution of humanity.
So did one plant make it out and everything came from that one plant?
So what happened is that, the soil bacteria and the algae exchanged genes using horizontal gene transfer. And then that made the algae hardier. So because those genes that they identified control plant development and stress, how it relates to stress. So, an environment where there's very little water is pretty stressful for something that lives in water. So that helps. So what happened, Jay, is that thousands, millions of years later, the descendants of those algae, those descendants became the plants that took root in all over the world. And so that's the relation. And so what they're going to do in the future is try to figure out more details about how exactly that gene transfer happened. But it's interesting because it makes me speculate, like, what would have happened if this did not happen?
Yeah.
There may be
something
no...
Something would have happened.
Probably would have happened later.
Yeah. We're looking back at what happened. So what's the chance of that happening? Very low. What's the chance of something happening?
Right.
It's almost guaranteed.
But it's like convergent evolution happens all the time. It's really interesting.
Absolutely. But what if for some reason, like, say what if the ultraviolet radiation was far too intense for land life to develop, even if some plant life... it's possible. What if we had an ozone hole that was so big it pretty much allowed, you know, UVC, which is very damaging
radiation. Well, this could be what it's like on Enceladus or what it's like on Europa. Nothing ever left the ocean.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I was wondering what would Earth be like with no land life at all, except maybe bacteria, of course.
Oh, so you're everywhere. You know, to fantasize a little bit, intelligent life could have evolved in the seas.
Right, but then you got to think, though, what kind of culture, how advanced could a culture in the water be if you can't create fire?
Aquaman.
Right, without fire, what would we do? You're not going to make radio telescopes if you can't have command over fire.
And we'd be cold. We'd just be cold all the time.
And our most intelligent life, I mean, of course, we have, again, an N of one. We look back at our own model. Yeah. Yeah. But our most intelligent life in the oceans went into the oceans. Mm-hmm. It didn't evolve in the oceans.
There's land.
It evolved on land and went back into the oceans.
A lot of examples. That's
all right, cool. Got to give you an update on measles, because this is a huge story in 2019. We're not quite done with 2019 yet, so a lot of the statistics come from 2018. Worldwide, 140,000 people died of measles. That's a lot. That's a dramatic increase from more recent years. Obviously, the best defense against measles is the vaccine.
Evidence of that is the fact that once measles vaccines were introduced, it went from like 2.8 million a year worldwide. So even 140,000 compared to that is a major difference. But it's gone up, which is not
but it's going
not
up.
Good.
So 86% of children around the world, 86% receive their first dose of the measles vaccine, but only 70% get the second dose. And the second dose is really necessary to have effective immunity. So only 70%. We need about 95% to prevent outbreaks, right? So we're there's a big difference between 70% and 95%.
And that's also assuming homogeneity across these populations. Like a big chunks of them
are have pockets of,
as we know,
if you have pockets. And in fact, we do have pockets. Yeah. And I know we like to blame anti-vaxxers. And yes, in developed nations, there are pockets of anti-vaxxers are significantly responsible for outbreaks. But worldwide, it's not anti-vaxxers that are the problem. It's poverty. It's poverty.
Yeah.
So the five countries that have the biggest outbreaks in 2018-2019 are the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, Liberia, Ukraine, Madagascar, and Somalia. Mm-hmm. And those five countries are responsible for half of the measles cases around the world. Well, and in those countries, not just poverty, it's also political upheaval, right? So the DRC is where there's currently an Ebola outbreak going on. In October of this year, we actually mentioned this on the show, the World Health Organization said, yeah, we're finally turning Ebola around. The numbers are starting to decrease. But now they're worried that they're starting to come back, that they're losing ground.
Why?
I'll tell you why. Because in about a week ago, I think while we were traveling, there was an attack on healthcare workers in the DRC.
What do you mean? They attacked people that are passing out the vaccine?
Yes, and they killed four healthcare workers and wounded seven. I don't know. Because it's a dangerous part of the world, and there's political upheaval. They don't trust Westerners, So the WHO had to recall, the World Health Organization had to recall a lot of healthcare workers, and now they need to increase security. But that has disrupted efforts.
So why don't they just give the vaccines to people from the country?
The vaccine's brand new also.
Why don't they give people the vaccines that are from the country to distribute the vaccines?
They do.
They do.
There are a lot of local healthcare workers who organize in this, but it's a massive effort.
And they don't have the infrastructure. So it's the countries that are not stable, that are poor, that are dangerous. That's where the diseases are the most, are spreading the most, that are the most dangerous. And of course, they present hotbeds that can spread to the rest of the world. Like, we're never going to get rid of the measles if it's, surviving in countries. Again, those five countries have half the world's measles.
A perfect example of that is when you look at poliovirus and how we're down to just a handful, like dozens at this point of cases. Those cases are typically in places that are very hard to reach.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're physically just in very remote villages where it's really hard to reach those people.
I liked it better when we could just hate the anti-vaxxers.
I know. It's easier. easier. And they're definitely not helping, but it's still a problem even without them. So this year, the United States is experiencing its highest rate of measles in 25 years.
How many people?
It's in the, I think it's up to the thousands of cases.
Yes.
Was that this year or was that last year?
No, that was years ago.
That was six, seven years ago. Yeah.
No.
Colorado very heavily this past year.
Colorado?
Yeah. I know, it seems like.
And of course, are they considering American Samoa? I don't know if they're utilizing that in American statistics or not.
No, I think it's just the
that's
states.
That's also contiguous. States. Yeah, that's also so new. Yeah, I don't even know if you...
And
the statistics change every day.
I think Western Australia is having an outbreak, the highest in 100 years.
Yikes.
And Australia's overall is experiencing a surge in measles cases. And that is largely due to anti-vaxxers. The idea, what was it, Melanie's Marvelous Measles, that measles is a benign illness.
Yeah.
It's not. It kills children. So the DRC is where the Ebola outbreak is happening. So in a year with the second worst Ebola outbreak ever, more than twice as many people have died in the DRC from measles than from Ebola.
Yep.
Right?
Wow.
Ebola has killed 2,000 people in DRC. Measles have killed 5,000. And they're mostly children under five. And also, another thing is that we talk a lot about vitamin A deficiency. One of the things about vitamin A deficiency is that it makes you more susceptible to measles and other infectious diseases.
And don't forget,
and so does poverty, just malnourishment, et cetera.
We've recorded so many shows in the past 30 days that I don't even know if this one went up yet. But I did talk about how measles wipes out your immunity memory.
Yeah.
Remember that?
I think we did. That did go up.
It did? Did you guys hear that one? These are all confounding.
Yeah.
It's like a pylon of things that make
So malnutrition and vitamin A deficiency makes you more susceptible to measles, which makes you more susceptible to all other infections because it's, wiping out.
Yeah, so if you survive measles, then you're still screwed.
You have a higher risk of dying from something else 6 months later. Absolutely. So it's like a domino effect.
Are you going to dive at all into what's going on in Samoa right now?
No, why don't you tell us?
Yeah. So in a country, there's only 200,000 people, right? So it's doable. but only 55% of those people are vaccinated. And it's now we're at the point where it's over 4,000 cases. Most of the cases and many, unfortunately, of the deaths are in young children. And it's gotten so bad now. This is an article that was just published, like, I think 2 days ago. They've started to put flags on the homes of unvaccinated individuals, which is a practice that was used, like, during the plague.
Yeah.
Like, this is, it's a rough state of affairs there. But luckily, the government is really working hard to kind of shut down any situation where a lot of people are in one place at once. And they have a huge vaccination campaign where they're offering the vaccine for free to every individual. And they're literally going around and canvassing person to person. Right.
But for some reason, people are deciding to kill these people that are trying to save
lives. Well, that was the DRC.
That was in the DRC. Okay, but so an anti-vaxxer in Samoa was just arrested.
Yeah.
Literally arrested for spreading anti-vax propaganda because it's directly leading
but
to death.
That's what we have to start doing. You know, it's one thing when we have the privilege, we think about how privileged we are. I mean, as an example, on this trip, I complained a lot.
Yes, he did.
But think about, like, you know, what am I complaining about? The woman that brought me my coffee this morning didn't give me the large. You know, like, no, seriously, this is a problem in my life.
Poor thing.
But to be fair, when it happens three times in a row,
it's so easy when we have all these clothes and food and transportation and everything to, you know, that little girl in the picture, like, it just makes me want to cry. Like, that shot is going to save her life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that shot is being delivered by people who are putting their lives at risk. Like, what kind of world do we live in where this is a problem? Like, I would happily give a portion of my income to, like, just make this problem go away with money.
Well, and also remember that when it comes to privilege, which is a word that we like to throw around quite a lot, privilege, I think we often forget, is not about us having and others not having. Privilege is about not realizing that other people don't have what you have. It's about being completely blind to the fact that what you have in this world is significantly better than what other people are dealing with.
The privilege and of taking it for granted.
Yes, and assuming that they are on the same level playing field.
Of course.
And we definitely are in a privileged position when it comes to this, for sure.
Very, very quickly, scientists are starting to track meteorites or meteors as they are burning through the atmosphere by people's dash cams, cell phone videos, and security cams.
Yeah.
And which actually provides, you know, higher, often higher quality imaging itself than the scientific instruments that they're using. But they're not all useful because they're useful if they have something in the foreground that tells you exactly what the perspective is in the location. Mm-hmm. People also don't necessarily always record exactly where and when they were when they saw it. But if there's enough of these videos out there, astronomers can actually figure out where the asteroid came from, like in the solar system, where it came from. Because they look at the trajectory. It's the trajectory,
And can they figure out where it landed to? Like they just get a bunch of cameras.
That's easy. But like knowing like this came from the asteroid belt versus whatever. That's really important.
You know, when we
really
went to the museum, I had this little fantasy while the geologist was talking to us about becoming like a meteor hunter. Yeah. You know, because they're
it would be cool.
It's cool. I know. There's like a lot.
It's your
to
job.
It.
I'm a meteorite hunter.
Yeah.
Meteorite hunter is a lot easier than meteor hunter.
Yeah.
Hard
all right.
To catch.
So we're going
to
do a new segment. Now, some of you may have realized, because I said it yesterday and it's been on the Twitters, that we asked you guys to submit your choice for, like, the biggest pseudoscience in Australia. And then we've sort of combined and collated those. And then our tech help, Ian, thank you, Ian, put them into various Twitter voting. So you can only put four things for each vote.
For each poll, And
so we clustered them into groups of four based upon some theme. Mm-hmm. And then you guys have been voting on which. So we're going to go by cluster. We'll talk about whatever one was number one of those four.
All right.
So Kara's got that all.
Yeah, got them all right here. Which alt-med SGU pseudoscience topic should we talk about today? So this was between traditional Chinese medicine, Reiki, acupuncture, and chiropractic. And overwhelmingly, with 46% of the vote, you guys voted for chiropractic.
Okay. You guys have a lot of chiropractors in Australia? Yeah. So there was just one, I can't remember who it was, one of the members was saying that before they were a skeptic, they went to a chiropractor, and the chiropractor literally got on their knees and begged them not to vaccinate their children. Thank you. There
oh
you
my
are.
Gosh.
Yeah, so that's... So chiropractors are not benign. The problem with talking about chiropractic or chiropractors is that it's a very broad umbrella. Yeah. There's a lot of things that happens under the rubric of chiropractic. But, and this is another conversation I was having just recently, what is unique to chiropractic is pseudoscience, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. And if chiropractors do anything that works, it's not unique to chiropractic. It's not chiropractic. It's something that chiropractic
medical doctors are doing it.
Or physical therapists or sports medicine or whatever.
And chiropractic is a gateway drug to pseudoscience.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's my biggest beef with it. It's like, I don't care if somebody goes and gets their back manipulated for a back problem that, it might be cheaper to treat it with other means, but that's, in and of itself, there's like some evidence that it may help. My problem is that they're going to go there, and then the chiropractor is going to beg them not to get it vaccinated.
Oh, my God.
Or that they're going to
what
then
the
do...
hell do you know? You know what I mean?
Like,
you should have kicked the guy when he was down. This is where I can't... Nope. I try so hard.
Bad advice from Jay.
I guess, it's so hard not to get pissed off.
Bad advice from Jay.
These idiots are all around us, and we let them keep doing this crap. Like, at what point do we say, I've had enough?
Yeah. You know what I mean?
I don't know. Let's do something though.
I know. Like you said.
Let's start a podcast.
Like you said, they might, urge you not to vaccinate your children, but gosh, we've covered stories where people are doing chiropractic on
babies.
And don't forget, remember when every now and then a chiropractor will adjust someone's neck and like, oh, I killed him.
Stroke. Oh, sorry about that. But they don't even admit that happens, even though the evidence is pretty clear that it does. And also they do things like applied kinesiology and iridology and acupuncture. So
it mixes in with all that.
A profession that cares a lot of pseudoscience.
When we were young, I went to a chiropractor. Yeah. I mean, the nutty stuff that they did, they're literally like making you hold a vial of sugar. And they do I am weak when I hold sugar in my hand, and it worked. It worked. Yeah. I believed it. The guy's whatever he's doing, he was doing it, and I totally bought a hook, line, and sinker. That idiot sent me to a guy that was shooting electricity through my hand and tell me what I was allergic to.
Yeah.
And it turns out I was allergic to all the things I put on the list that I like to eat.
Yeah.
Peanut butter, oranges, tomato sauce, meatball. I saw meatballs. I'm like, I'm out. I don't give a shit if it kills me.
Live with the pain.
I remember going to one, and just when we were really getting into critical thinking and skepticism, and I told him I'm a skeptic. He's like, "Oh, you're a cynic, right?" I'm like, "No, wait, those aren't synonyms." I mean, it was bad.
And you notice too that chiropractors always have. How many people in here have ever gone to a spa to get like a facial? Yeah, a few people. You notice at the end of the facial, they're like, now you need to buy all the shit I put on your face. Yeah. And that's what chiropractors do. They have their own line of supplements and their own line of
But not just that. One of the things that got to me was that if you go in with a back problem and somehow they make it feel a little bit better, what they want to do is they want you to come back on a maintenance program. Though. Come every month, few weeks for maintenance.
No evidence.
Schedule your next 12 session.
What was that chiropractor book? How to Make a Patient for Life? That's an actual title of a chiropractor book.
Yeah. All right. What is the next category?
All right. So we've got food pseudoscience. Which food pseudoscience should we talk about? And we've got two of these, actually. So we'll start with the first one. Detox juices, superfoods, supplements, and coconut oil. And overwhelmingly, you guys voted supplements.
Supplements.
Yeah.
That's easy.
Yeah, that one's easy.
That's an easy
one.
So
easy.
You don't need them. They're very expensive.
Well, so let's talk about different kinds of supplements, because the term is, as a regulatory term, it's all over the place. And I think most of the public don't really think, in terms of specific definitions. So... from a regulatory point of view, supplements is basically, in a lot of countries like the U.S., is anything that's not a drug, right? Mm-hmm. Anything you take that's not a drug. But I think what most people think of as supplements is like vitamins and minerals, right? And I think that's what the term really means. Like you're supplementing your nutrition, not with food, but with, concentrated vitamins or minerals or enzymes or probiotics, stuff like that in a pill form. So here's the bottom line on supplements. I do think that this is something where even a lot of scientists, a lot of skeptics, a lot of people who are generally well-informed, I think we've been so brainwashed that, take your vitamin every day is of course, that's a good thing to do, that it's hard to get out of that. But when you really look at the data, there's no evidence for the caveat, routine supplementation. Mm-hmm. What that means is you have no particular reason why you need to take a supplement. Like if you're not low in it, you're not pregnant,
if your doctor,
you're not getting surgery.
Yeah, and it's telling you specifically, hey, you have a deficiency.
Like I prescribe vitamins every day in my practice, pretty much. Yeah. But they're
and
to
it's
people
the
who are low,
brain, right? Your picture's on the bottle.
I wish. Yeah. No, it's the people who are low. I check their levels.
What are they low?
And
on?
They're low. Well, like migraineurs tend to be low in B2, and if you supplement their B2, they get it helps a little bit. So that's
so you have to make a decision on whether to prescribe them 2B or not 2B.
Yeah.
Damn, that was like Evan class, right?
Evan's so proud. Look at him. Guys, I highly recommend, and you probably already know about it because this is an Australian production company, Gene Pool Productions, led by Sonia Pemberton. She did a great documentary starring a good friend of mine, Derek Muller, called Vitamania. Very good. Recommend it. Comes to the same. You were in it. Yeah. Comes to, you know, basically that conclusion. Yeah, like, eat well.
Yeah.
And
we know it's not a substitute for eating well.
Exactly.
We know there's no benefit if you do eat well. Right. And so unless you have a specific reason. And the other thing is there's actually some evidence that it could be harmful.
Sure.
Although that's a really hard question to answer definitively, but there are some large studies which show, so certainly mega dosing, there's no reason to do that.
Yeah, where there's like 7,000% of your daily
and you
intake.
You increase the risk of actually harming yourself if you do that.
Okay, so the next one is about kind of catch-all, kind of classic pseudoscience. And this one says, should we talk about astrology? Astrology.
That's a vote for climate change. Denial.
Climate change denial, homeopathy, or clean coal. And up to just a few minutes ago, clean coal and climate change denial were
neck and neck.
But climate change denial pulled forward by 1%.
All right, let's talk about clean coal. Because we've talked about climate change.
That's true. We talked about it yesterday. Yeah.
And the clean coal thing, that's such a huge category. Clean coal is a little bit more focused. There's no such thing, right? So there's actually four types of coal. There's peat.
Right.
Peat coal.
Right. There is the other one.
Something.
Yes. Begins with an L. The one.
Lignite.
Lignite.
Yep, I knew that.
Right? Yeah, lignite.
And then there's the bituminous.
Yeah.
Yep. So the lignite and the peat are two energy. They're not energy dense enough to really be used for energy production, for burning. So you can burn them, but they're not really used.
I think I could copy. I can talk what you're saying as you're saying it.
No, you can't.
Stop.
That's not annoying.
The bituminous is like dirty coal. It has a lot of contaminants in it, more sulfur, more uranium and other crap. And then there's like the dark black coal that you think of when you think of coal. That's the clean coal. But it's still coal, right? It's still releasing soot and carbon and pollution into the air. So it's basically, you should think of it as slightly less dirty coal.
Yeah.
Right? Clean coal, the framing of clean coal is really very, very, very
deceptive.
Which
is the coal that Santa Claus gives you? Which are those four?
It depends on how bad you were.
Right.
So sometimes there are some countries that like produce bituminous coal and they burn it because it's cheap and local, but it's really, really dirty.
Yeah.
But you want, the dark black coal.
But clean coal is basically then is what you think it is, coal is. It's not like some new variant that they created.
Right.
You think it's coal, that's clean coal.
Yeah.
Because, how often do you think of bituminous?
Like, you can't have clean coal.
Peat.
It's marketing.
It's a label.
It's time for science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
We are going to have a guest for this episode of Science or Fiction. The guest's name is Lola Lucic Marshall. Lola, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, Lola.
Hi.
Lola, how old are you?
I'm 12 years old.
12 years old.
Yeah, and we decided to have Lola on the show because she's adorable.
And brilliant.
Yes.
Yes.
And that's pretty much it. that was enough.
I had more. I told her I wanted her to solve the future world problems. It's all on you. Everyone in here wants you to fix the future.
You are the future of skepticism.
Thanks, Lola.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Every time I see her walk by today, I sing that song Lola in my head all day. I like the song, so I didn't mind. Thank you.
Lola, what's your favorite sign?
When I was younger, when I was up to 7 years old, I think, I really wanted to be a paleontologist.
That's a good choice. That was my first choice, too, when I was younger.
I knew so much about dinosaurs.
Did it change?
Yes.
Okay. What's now?
Like, now I do still like skepticism and science. It's really awesome and it's a big part of the world, but I really love art and being creative.
Amazing. Yeah. Cool. Can't have one without the other. I don't think.
Yes. Now, I know the answer to this question, but who's your favorite rogue?
That's me.
No, come on. We know.
Kara.
Can you
Jay, I was in second place.
Can you tell us why?
Tell me what you told me yesterday about our names and our birthdays.
Oh, yeah. We have the same middle name, Louise. Mm-hmm. And our birthdays are in October.
Yes, both October babies, both named Louise.
But you also, Kara wrote you a letter.
Yes, she did.
Yeah, tell us about that.
In 2017, when my dad went to a skeptic conference, my dad asked you to write me a letter, and it was really thoughtful, and I still have it at home.
So you weren't there, right? You were 10 years old
I was 10 years old.
10 years old. And she still has a letter. I'm going to cry. Okay, we need to move on. We need to move on.
So, okay, Lola, you ready for science fiction?
I think so.
Do you know how to play?
Yes.
Good, okay. So, there's a theme this week.
Oh, no.
I thought of that theme before I knew she was going to be on the show, but it's okay, because you can still use your science to figure this out.
Okay.
So on this trip, I drink tea. I don't like coffee. But I'm surrounded by people who are obsessed with coffee.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Like everyone in this room.
Yeah.
My dad.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently, Australia has better coffee than the United States.
Yeah. It's true. All
right. But I have to say the tea options were a little limited. Just saying. That's okay. So we'll see how much my coffee-obsessed rogues know about coffee.
Wow.
This is so unfair.
It's totally unfair.
Jay is massively obsessed.
Don't even know, because I'm going to lose and I'm going to look like an idiot.
Hey, Jay,
yeah.
I lost the mental health one.
You did.
Yeah, it happens.
I hardly even drink coffee. Like, I've only drank it like once. So how am I supposed to know anything?
Did you like it when you drank it?
Yes.
Yeah, she liked it. Yeah.
You don't have to be, drink coffee to do well. I said you could use your critical thinking, sciencey chops here, okay?
Yeah. Good, that's me.
All right, four items. I might have missed it.
Oh, okay.
It's four items. All right, so item number one. A scoop of light roast coffee beans has more caffeine than a scoop of dark roast coffee beans.
Okay.
Item number two. Coffee with cream will cool more slowly than without. Okay. Item number three. So that's thermodynamics. You know thermodynamics. Right? Three, coffee is the most traded commodity worldwide. And four, epidemics of coffee rust, a fungal infection that plagues Arabica coffee worldwide, affects 70% of crops in Central America, and in bad years, entire crops have been lost. All right, so you guys know about the single clap method. We're going to practice when I get to hear you clap. Very good. All right,
good.
So if you think you're going to clap for the one you think is the fiction, right? So if you think the light roast, dark roast one is the fiction, clap. If you think that the cream makes it cool more slowly, clap. If you think that... All right.
We lost it over here.
All right, you need a cup of coffee over there. If you think that coffee is the most traded commodity worldwide is the fiction, clap. And if you think that the epidemic of coffee rust is the fiction, clap. Only a couple of people. Okay. All right, so I thought three and then one.
Yeah, one a little bit. But
one was closed, but the third. Okay, so Evan, with that.
Full disclosure, I do not drink coffee. American, Australian, New Zealand, or otherwise. So, full disclosure. So,
how is that possible?
It's bitter. I don't like it.
That's why it's cream and equal.
But if you're going to go through all that.
For a delicious drink, yes, I will.
Yeah. That wakes you up.
Oh, you can't argue.
Fine, we don't have time.
Can't argue. Okay.
All right, reverse order. Fungal infection, yes. I'm aware of coffee and cocoa and other things. They tend to have infections at outbreaks at times, and I'm not surprised by those numbers at all. So that one's going to be science. Now, coffee being the most traded commodity worldwide, oh, boy, this one's nebulous, and I think kind of the audience was picking up on this. I mean, there are other, there are other things that are traded, like gold. And, I mean, is that a commodity? I mean,
Gold is a commodity.
Yes, it is. So, but, there are so many other things. That coffee, the most traded commodity worldwide? You know, water? I don't know. Do people trade water?
I don't think so.
I don't know about that one. Now, coffee with cream cooling more slowly than without. I think that's, if any of them are the gotcha one, folks, we'll find out. That I think that would be the one. What are the thermodynamics of this? And if I had a better handle on that, I might be able to make a more educated guess. But I'll kind of ride with the audience in thinking that one's science. And then the other one was light roast versus dark roast, that there is a difference between the two as far as the caffeine. So that's kind of a simple choice. I don't think you would simply just reverse that one. So I'm kind of going meta with the science or fiction. So I think that one is going to be science. Therefore, I will go with the very, very sophisticated audience in saying that coffee is not the most traded commodity worldwide.
Okay, Bob.
All right. These are good, Steve. Nothing was really obvious. The audience has definitely has helped me a little bit. So let's see. More caffeine based on the roast. I don't know. Let's go to the second one. The coffee cooling more slowly. Yeah, it could be a quirk of thermodynamics. I know that you've all heard, when you make ice, if you make ice with cool water or hot water, it actually, crystallizes faster if it's hot, which doesn't make any sense. And wait, is that even true?
Oh, no.
It could be a myth. But yeah, a little quirk of thermodynamics. I could see there could be some weird explanation for that one. The epidemic one, I don't know. I'd never heard of it. But yeah, the one that got to me, though, was this third one. Most traded commodity. I mean, pork bellies, orange juice, oil.
I saw that.
Oil? Yeah, I'll say that one's fiction, too.
All right, Jay?
I'll go take them backwards. So the epidemics of coffee rust, I believe that one is science. There's lots of crops that are being hit by something, and that one definitely is science. So coffee is the most traded commodity in the world. I'll save that one for last. A scoop of light roast coffee beans has more caffeine than a scoop of dark roast coffee beans. Well, the roasting process, I believe, destroys the caffeine molecule. So that one is to me, is science. Coffee with cream will cool more slowly than without. I think that that one is also science. I think what's happening is the cream can be like a barrier to trap the heat. So I'm going to say that this one about the coffee being the most traded commodity is the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
I think that the last one we all agree with. I think that I know that drip coffee has way more caffeine than espresso. But I don't know about the light versus dark, but it seems reasonable that the more you roast it, the more you destroy caffeine. I know that the decaf process actually degrades the coffee bean so much that usually the highest quality beans are used for decaf, which is interesting.
I can't help you.
Isn't that sad? I know. I'm just looking. I'm like cold reading. Yeah. So
I get it.
The cream thing, I think it's like it initially gets you because you think cream is cold.
Whoa!
And you put cold cream into your coffee.
I'm trying to help
and
you.
Then you're like, but I think you're saying all things being equal.
I like equal.
Yeah. No, you can't.
There's a cup of hot coffee with no cream.
The cream is going to cool the coffee up, but from that moment, what happens?
Yeah, if you heat up a cup of coffee with cream to the same temperature as a cup of coffee with no cream, then the coffee with cream will stay hot longer,
right,
is what it's saying. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, maybe milk is a heat trap. That seems like it's the gotcha one, right? Because of the initial reaction. Mm-hmm. So coffee being the most traded commodity worldwide, I know it's highly traded. It's probably up there. But if you look at a panel of 6 people, only half of the people on this panel actually drink coffee. And I mean, I don't think everybody in the world drinks coffee, but there are other things that everybody in the world consumes, right? Yep. So just for that reason alone. But I don't know what most traded means. Like, is the quantity the highest? Is the amount of cash trading hands highest? Are there
the
more
value.
Sources of the coffee beans than anything else? I don't, it's too, it's a vague. Yeah. So yeah, he's probably going to be like, it's true, because in this one aspect of it, it is the most traded. But
And what's funny, that's how I hear Steve's voice in my head, too.
Was that an impersonation? That was pretty good.
But here's the thing.
Trading a commodity, that's a well-established concept. I mean,
yeah,
there's no gotchas in there.
Most traded means what?
Right. He will tell us. Trust me, he will tell us.
Yeah, he will tell us, but we don't know.
Right.
I went out on a limb during the private show, and it did not do me well. So I think I'm going to stick with the guys and say that.
Kara's Italian.
It is not. I am Italian. My last name is Santa Maria. I'm going to say that, coffee is not the most traded commodity in the world.
All right, Lola, what do you think? Be independent. Be strong.
Thank you. Well, the first one a scoop of light roast coffee beans has more caffeine than a scoop of dark roast coffee beans. I mean, that might be true because, like, as Kara said, the more you roast something, or, like, the more you cook something, like, you destroy, like, bacteria. Mm-hmm. So it might be the same with caffeine.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that one's true.
Okay.
And coffee with cream will cool more slowly than without. Well, coffee, I actually don't know anything about this one, but...
It's thermodynamics.
Just like thermodynamics. That's the hint.
That will give you the answer.
But I think, like, coffee, cream is, like, cold, so it might help it cool down.
Mm-hmm.
And coffee is the most traded commodity in worldwide. I don't think that one's true because a lot of people don't drink coffee, but a lot of people, like, everyone in the world drinks water, and so that might be, like...
Yeah.
Something that's more traded. Mm-hmm. And like other foods that most people eat.
Yeah, like rice or, yeah, like staple crops,
of course,
right? Yeah,
corn.
You think.
All right, so you think that one's the fiction.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, since Steve, as usual, I recognize an assumption that I made that, that probably...
Nobody cares if it's...
All right, hit me.
All right, when I put cream in my coffee, I take it out of the refrigerator, so it's cool. But you could also add cream that's room temperature. So are you? Did you hear what Kara said?
Yeah, we said we're assuming that both cups are the same temperature.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the cream
will be made clear.
No. Initially, yes.
All right.
That's the whole idea. Initially, they're the same temperature. But if you add cold cream, or
both a cup with cream versus a cup without cream are both the same temperature.
Excuse me.
But there's no. Of course, that's what it is because it's like if you throw ice cubes in your coffee, it's going to get cold.
Jay, have you never heard of that thing about the ice cubes?
All right,
hot
all right.
water. Look it up.
Is that a myth?
I'm not going to bother surveying the audience because basically the audience agrees with the panel. So let's just go on.
Wait,
I'll tell
on.
You about
Whoa.
The ice cubes.
But they did. They agreed beforehand. Then we agreed
with them. But the information has been given to the audience that they didn't have, and they might have changed their mind. So I think you should do it again.
Okay, so I'm going to waste time finding.
Yes.
Out
yeah.
All right. So if you think that the roast makes the difference in the caffeine, then clap. If you think that the coffee or cream will cool more slowly is the fiction, clap. If you think that coffee is the most traded commodity is the fiction, clap. Yeah. And if you think that the coffee rust is the fiction, clap.
Good for you.
Three people. All right. So.
I think Steve might have swept us.
No. A few people went out on a limb there.
Okay.
So, yeah, so no overall difference there. So let's say that we'll start with four. Epidemics of coffee rust, a fungal infection that plagues Arabica coffee worldwide, affects 70% of the crops of Central America, and in bad years, entire crops have been lost. That is science.
Okay.
The Arabica coffee industry around the world is being threatened by this fungal infection. It's very serious. By the way, there's basically two types of coffee in the world. There's Arabica, and you guys know what the other one is? Robusta. Thank you very much. Robusta is more robust, but it tastes like shit, apparently. And so it's more bitter. It's a lot more bitter.
Yeah.
And so that's why Arabica is like the coffee that most people drink. Apparently they use the Robusta for the freeze-dried coffee because that tastes like shit anyway.
Yeah.
So
that's
you can't,
the airline coffee.
Yeah, that's the airline. It's Robusta.
Oh, wait, speaking of shit, where does the civet coffee?
That's the civet coffee, which I know you guys all know about. That's the cat poop coffee. That's the most expensive coffee in the world.
It's also it's like horrible from a conservation angle. Like, don't buy
When you
coffee.
Buy coffee like in a supermarket or dare I even say, sorry, in even Starbucks, they're mixing lots of coffees.
Yeah, but it's probably all Arabica.
I haven't tried much coffee, but my dad is definitely the best from what I've tried.
Oh, yeah? Your dad's coffee?
Yes. It's like his hobby.
We're going to like him.
You've probably had more coffee than me.
Yeah. I mean, we're invited over for coffee.
And definitely.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
As long as you fly over to South Australia.
Oh, crap.
So the other problem is that the coffee has a very narrow zone where you could grow it, you know, profitably. You have to be, I think, 15 degrees north or south of the equator, about 1,000 miles.
Yeah,
but also it has to be tropical, but then also at high altitude, lots of rain. So you need, like, all those things. You need a lot of sun, a lot of water. There isn't any cultivar that can be grown, like, in America outside of Hawaii, right?
Yeah, it's all South America.
But in northern Australia, but not southern Australia.
Are they working on, like, a GM Arabica
yes.
or something? They are. Cool.
Yes.
To
good.
Fight against
and
that
And the conversation is the public going to accept it? But they absolutely are working
Bring
on
it. On.
But again,
when
the Arabica coffee, you know, plantations are getting wiped out, they will have no problem with the GM.
No.
They're working on a bean that can grind itself.
Yeah. The self-grinding coffee bean. All right, let's go to number 2. two, because that was the other one I think that most people agreed on. With coffee, with cream will cool more slowly than without. That is science.
Okay.
So that is that was kind of a soft gotcha.
Was I right?
Yeah. No, you were all wrong about why.
Don't care.
But we're right about the assumption that they started in the same.
You were right about the assumption. Okay. Or the other way you could look at it is you have two cups of coffee that are the same temperature. You put cream in one, and then you wait 5 minutes, and then put cream in the other.
Okay.
So the amount of cooling from the cream is the same. Mm-hmm. Which cup is going to be warmer at the end of that process? So the practical question is, do you immediately put your cream in your coffee and then let it cool? Or do you put it when you're ready to drink it? Like what would keep your coffee warmer longer?
Interesting.
Yeah. So putting the cream in first will keep it warmer longer.
Yes. Even if it's colder cream.
Yeah. Well, because I'm assuming that the same cooling from the cream.
What's
is going
the mechanism? Over.
So there's a few.
Okay.
Right. So one is that cream is viscous, and so less of the coffee will evaporate, and most of the cooling is evaporation. Mm. So if you slow the evaporation, you slow the cooling.
So wait. So that I said that it can kind of make a barrier. So the
yeah, but it's the barrier to evaporation, not just the heat loss.
It doesn't make a skin on top.
I didn't that way.
But you didn't say the magic word. The start, it's not like there's a skin. It's the viscosity of the coffee itself with the cream.
At the start, I thought you meant like you put cream on top of the coffee.
No, it's cream on the coffee.
Make it
All right.
That would be
a total barrier.
Like whipped cream on coffee.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Now I want a coffee.
But also, let me beat this horse to death about the ice. I looked it up. The Mpemba effect, hot water in a freezer will become ice more quickly than cold water in a freezer.
Right. But the volume is less because it evaporates. That's why.
Well, okay.
So smaller cubes, right.
You're not freezing the same amount of ice quicker. You're freezing the ice cube quicker, but the ice cube is smaller.
If you want smaller cubes.
Okay, but if you want fast ice cubes, go with the hot water.
Or just put less water in the ice.
Well, you can do that too.
All right. This is what dinner is like at the Novella House.
Practical
but the
advice.
Other effect is the warmer something is, the faster it cools off. So if you cool it off first with the cream, it's less warm to cool. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Less warm to cool.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to number one. A scoop of light roast coffee beans has more caffeine than
I'll
a scoop of
one.
Dark.
Okay. So when you roast.
So, let me just say, so far, everything you've said is wrong. But
no,
go.
I'm not wrong. The roasting process does destroy the caffeine molecule.
That's not what I read.
Steve, that is a fact.
All right.
That is a fact.
Let me tell you what I read.
Okay.
That may be true, but here's the thing. The key to this one was the scoop, right? So in other words, per volume, light roast has more caffeine than dark roast. But everything I read did not mention that it's because the roasting process destroys caffeine.
Oh, just when you roast it, they get smaller?
Yes.
Oh, they shrivel.
So the light roast is denser.
Yeah.
Light roast is denser. The more you roast it, the more
water comes
fluffy, fluffy it gets. Yeah. So per volume, light roast has more caffeine. Per weight, dark roast has more caffeine.
Interesting. So a scoop.
That's a fact, brother.
That's per volume.
Volume. So the trick there was seeing scoop and realizing that meant volume, not weight.
Yeah. Well, right, we would have had to know all of that previous knowledge,
so
too.
That's cool. And I do remember, and now that you say it, my brother-in-law, Scott, did tell me that.
Yeah.
But I also read that the heat breaks up the molecule.
Yeah, but it may be, right.
Okay. I could be wrong. But I will look at it.
Now, here's another interesting factoid I came across when I was researching coffee. Lighter roasts are becoming more popular because the whole point of dark roast is to cover the bitterness of the coffee. Mm-hmm. So you can't really do a light roast of a crappy coffee. But they're breeding so many much better cultivars of coffee that you can get away with lighter roasts. And you could then taste a lot of the softer notes because there's not as much bitterness in it. Anyway, not that I care.
Yeah.
All right. So all of this
means...
that coffee is the most traded commodity worldwide is the fiction. I debated whether or not to make this one the fiction because I figured that people wouldn't go for that. And the truth is actually pretty surprising. So again, you're all kind of wrong in your reasoning because coffee is far and away the most traded food commodity in the world.
Yeah. Okay.
And maybe I should have done that in retrospect. That would have been a good
sign. We would have gotten that wrong. Yeah.
So there's one. It's also the second most traded commodity in the world. The second most traded commodity.
What's
it's a massive. That's a good question. What's the first? Oil. Crude oil.
Yeah,
is
of course. Bing.
Crude oil is about twice coffee, and then coffee is a lot more than pretty much anything
else. Oh, so as we see those changes occurring in our oil usage, we might actually
coffee
see...
Coffee may become number one.
That's interesting.
Coffee is massively popular. Also, Scandinavia, they drink like 8 cups of coffee a day on average.
What's wrong with that? Is that a problem?
It's because the sun never sets.
It's fine because it's cold and they need a hot beverage.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So well done, Lola.
I was wrong.
What? You were wrong.
Yeah. It is the actual because the weight of the bean changes.
The weight. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I can admit when I'm wrong.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wait. Let's just enjoy this moment for a second.
All right. I do try to do my research.
I am a trained skeptic, and I don't care if I'm right or wrong. I want to know what the truth is.
I know, but we're talking about coffee, Jay. I mean,
but Bob, you know what's the most important thing? That I get to drink it.
Yeah, okay.
That's it.
Agreed, the most important thing is now we are moving on. All right, we have just time for a quote, Evan.
I like this quote because it ties into some things today. What Kara's topic, the science or fiction, and certainly the audience ahead of us. NCCAM officials have spent $374,000 to find that inhaling lemon and lavender scents do not promote wound healing. $750,000 to find that prayer does not cure AIDS or hasten recovery from breast reconstruction surgery. $390,000 to find that ancient Indian remedies do not control type 2 diabetes. $700,000 to find that magnets do not treat arthritis, carpal tunnel syndrome, or migraine headaches. And $406,000 to find that coffee enemas do not cure pancreatic cancer. And that was a quote by Paul Offit. This quote was submitted to us back in 2012 by SGU listener Kevin Mack of Melbourne.
Yeah.
So listen, you guys have been great. We have, you've been, the hospitality in Melbourne and Australia in general has been fantastic. You guys have really made us feel welcome. We love these trips down here. Yeah. So thank you all for joining
thank
us
you
for this
guys.
Episode.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I thank my panel as always, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.